That was so great.
Magic 98. Yeah. Margaret and I are going back and forth on how to just very much remind you all to get on the Patreon.
We're overthinking it and we'd rather not. So can you not overthink it? Don't question, like, should I give him $5 or not a month? I can't decide.
You can do it. So here it is.
Not, maybe $10 a month. It's not a big deal.
You're really going to support our trajectory here. Okay. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Like, the launch.
Yeah.
More of the launching.
Do you guys want one of those hoodies? This is easy.
And again, it's going to be this really great relationship builder. We have so many great things to share over there with patrons.
Yeah.
It's gonna be like bonus, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
All right, no more convincing, no more nothing.
We'll see you on Patreon.
You're listening to Let's Do This! ! Okay, everyone. You're gonna wanna really tune into this one.
And share it. And tell your friends about it. It doesn't matter what is between your legs and what gender you are. This is for everybody.
This is such a great combo that we had with the incredible Erica Mather. She embodies many roles, but the reason why we had her on the podcast back, we sat down with her back in May, is because of her book that came out.
Your Body, Your Best Friend, End the Confidence-Crushing Pursuit of Unrealistic Beauty Standards and Embrace Your True Power.
Yeah, this is not your typical body image book. I'm just going to tell you all right now. Like, this book, it's really incredible. It's not going to be what you think it's going to be.
Uh-huh.
It's not.
Really makes you look inside.
Yeah.
And so this topic, it's close to home for all of us. Can we just get real about that? We're all in these bodies. Mm-hmm. We have days where we're like, yeah, I'm pretty okay with this body I'm walking around in. And we've all had our times, years, our struggles, our really, you know, face-to-face reality of how our thoughts get really fucked up about these bodies we're in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we both have witnessed each other in this specific way, pretty vulnerably, actually.
Oh yeah.
I mean, I haven't quite ended my relationship with diet culture. I'm just gonna be real.
Yeah.
Like, I get sucked into it on a regular basis.
Oh yeah.
And I was expressing to you recently with tears, like, I'm so exhausted of wasting my time thinking about this shit.
Yeah.
And for women more specifically, it is definitely saturated in our brains. Like, oh, yeah. Every single day, to some degree, we are thinking about what we're eating.
It's obsessive. It can be
obsessive. It's obsessive. And oh, man, it's fucking hard.
It is fucking hard. And we've carried children in these bodies, and that was a trip.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This, Erica, it was so great to have you on the show, and keep up the good work.
Thank you, Erica.
And you know, we all come to our journeys for reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And Erica, you know, this has been a journey for you. And I'm just like, I just feel so grateful that there are people in the world that have that courage to be really vulnerable and really honest with their own story to better the lives of others.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that is just powerful and beautiful when people do that. We're like, you know what? This has been really fucking hard for me. And I don't want it to be this hard for other people. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to do the work. And I'm going to put myself out there. And I'm going to think about this shit. And I want to help.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
That's powerful.
It was wonderful to sit down with her.
I mean, I just, yeah.
And we unpacked a lot with her. And I just kind of, you know, I highlighted the shit out of this book. This is a book that I'm just going to send in the mail to a number of people in my life. And, you know, the holidays will be a great time to do it, because it's not the kind of book where you're like, can I borrow this?
Yeah.
It's like a manual that you're going to need to, like, refer to, I think, a lot.
Yeah.
But I'm just going to read it real quick here.
Yeah, just open it up.
The body does not speak English. It speaks food, rest, movement, and touch.
Oh, chills. Erica?
Yeah. Better to spend your time getting to know the one body you have, honestly, honestly, and without any delusions or fantasies. Revere the fact that there will never be another one like yours. Be in awe of the probability that you came to inhabit it, a slight probability, if you really consider the odds of reproduction. It's really quite amazing.
Well said. You guys, enjoy this interview. Get the book. Let's read the title of the book. It's, we say it in the interview again, but we're going to just keep saying it. Your Body, Your Best Friend.
Erica Mather.
And she's everywhere. This is not her first podcast interview. She's on YouTube. She's a yoga instructor. She's a speaker. She's an educator. Yeah. She's someone that you're going to want to know about and tell other people about.
I think so.
Big time.
Yeah. Big time. So thanks again, Erica.
Thank you.
Thanks for honoring our process of the time, the timeline that we're on with interviews.
Divine timing.
Yeah. Yeah.
COVID.
It was a real treat to go back and listen. It was actually really, I was like, God, this is so great.
And it was great timing.
Mm-hmm. All right, everyone.
Enjoy.
Enjoy. Well, we welcome.
This is not your first podcast.
No.
Interview. No.
No, but it's been a while.
Has it? Okay. All right. Let's dive. Let's dive in.
It's been a while, and also you prepared, and I'm used to not getting anything like this. I'm used to showing up really? And not having received. Yeah. So the podcast that I've been on, like the spectrum of preparedness of the people hosting the podcast, it varies wildly. So I've been on podcasts where it was like, I was given a list of questions and then my answers were like streamlined, like vetted by the host and streamlined, like, no, it's gotta be faster. I'm like, oh, okay.
Okay.
to like literally like unstructured 75 minute conversations.
Right. That's going to be a little bit more our style.
No, that's great.
Yeah.
But I am happy to have had like an outline to sort of focus me on what might be interesting to you to talk about. So, yeah.
Well, I have to say, your book is incredible.
Thank you so much.
Your Body, Your Best Friend. It is awesome. I'm telling all the people about it, Erica. I think it's going to be the book that I send in the mail to a number of people in my life.
I'm so happy to hear that. Thank you.
It's incredible.
Who's got the chills? I really got them going. I mean, now it's coming up the face.
Yeah. Making your scalp tingle.
Yeah, and we're going to get to the book, but let's... So you're an author, you're a speaker, you're an educator, and at the center of all of that seems to be the real strong yoga practice.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about, I mean, well, you're in New York City too, by the way, now, but you're a Madison, Wisconsin born human.
I am a Madison, Wisconsin born human. So I'm very familiar with Midwestern culture.
Yes.
Having grown up in the middle of it. So if your listeners are, I don't know where your audience really is, but if listeners are mostly Wisconsin or Wisconsin based or Midwest. I was born in Madison, Wisconsin. I moved to New York in 2004 to go to graduate school here. And then I just, I just hung around because I just felt like when I moved on from graduate school, my time, I was just starting in New York City and I didn't want to just like, you know, boomerang back to Madison and be like, well, now what? So, yeah. So, there are a few Wisconsin people out here who, I was on the music scene in Madison with for a while. And
you were a pianist? Right,
because yoga came later. Yeah. First and foremost, it was your musical journey that was front and center for you from a young age.
Yes. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. And so my Madison life was my music life. And then it sort of dovetailed into New York. And then I realized there was no way really to make a living as a musician here. That was really the big deal. There was no way to make a living as a musician. And that's kind of when I transitioned into teaching yoga, because it was much more apparent to me, apart from it being like a personal practice that was very near and dear to me. Mm-hmm. But it also was apparent to me that I was going to be able to make a living much more easily as a yoga teacher in New York City than I was going to be teaching music or even mm-hmm. playing. So yeah, so I am I'm not an Englishman in New York. I'm a cheesehead in Manhattan.
Nothing wrong with that.
Cheesehead in Manhattan. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what else can I tell you?
Well, the forest yoga, or did I get that right?
Yeah, it's forest yoga. Okay. Yeah, that's right.
And is it a guardianship that you can
elaborate on what that is?
You earn it in a way,
or yeah, how you earn it?
Yeah, yeah, it's yeah, pretty special yeah. from what I'm
own
gathering.
It.
Yeah.
Own it. Yeah, I earned it.
I earned. Yeah. Well, I hesitate around that because because the earning now is much more articulated than when I became a guardian. So first of all, let me explain what forest yoga is and then what guardianship is for your listeners. So forest yoga is a style of practice created by my teacher, whose name is Anna Forrest. And so in case you're thinking that like forest yoga is done in the forest, it's not like that. But I think that her name is evocative of the values in forest yoga, which is very earth-centric, very nature-centric, very organic-centric, very body-centric, with this sure. view of the body as a part of the fabric of the world instead of some machine that you're supposed to teach how to behave like a machine. So, so Anna Forrest is my teacher. And when I became a guardian in 2009, and so let me explain what guardian is, and then I'll tell the rest of the story. When I became a guardian, being a guardian means like being a lineage holder. Mm. So it is someone besides the key teacher, the teacher who created the lineage. It is a teacher besides the person who created the lineage, who is responsible for like holding the integrity and the mission and the pledge of the lineage itself. So I was invited to be a guardian in 2009. And there were certain things that I had to do to earn it, but mostly then it was because guardianship was a new thing in 2009. I think it was a second generation guardian.
Okay.
So the first generation of guardians were invited, and many of them had been very long time practitioners. And then I was like second generation. And in 2009, I had only really been a forest yoga teacher since 2006. So it was not a very long apprenticeship, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that is because the station of being a guardian was so new that you had to populate it somehow with people. But Anna was hand-picking people at that point, sort of from the teachers who were committed to teaching it. And so the way that I earned being a guardian was less clear to me at the time because I received an invitation over the phone.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right. And now if you want to be a guardian, the steps to become a guardian are codified and people have to move through them. Right. But at that point, it was even not clear to me, like, how did I earn this? Mm-hmm. And apart from my commitment to forest yoga, but Anna told me that she knew that she wanted me to be a guardian when I toured with her for a couple weeks to England. So I went on the road with her and basically mm-hmm. assisted her. And she said that was like 2007. So I was a very fresh teacher, very fresh yoga teacher. Let's say I have been teaching in some capacity since I was 17, but teaching yoga, I was a very young yoga teacher. But she said in 2007, I knew that I wanted you when you came with us. And I think that Anna is looking for skills and assets that are,
that's a New York City siren, isn't it?
That is a New York City yes. siren. Yes, that yep. is. My window is closed, by the way. So, I mean, it's closed yeah. all the way. I live across the street from a hospital and down the street
wow.
from a precinct. So it's very siren-y here. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But the skill sets that Anna's looking for are what we call in forest yoga, like mystery school. It's like part of a mystery school skill sets. And I think the skills that she saw that I had and I have was an ability to empathize in a particular way that is very useful as a yoga teacher.
Mm.
So a skill for empathy, which I think is brought to bear in the book. And a skill also for just the technique of teaching yoga. And teaching yoga is almost, when it's done well, it's like casting a spell.
Mm-hmm.
Mm, well said.
So,
very well said, yes.
So you yes. cast a spell, and it's a benevolent spell, obviously. But yeah. the people who are in the spell have a different experience of themselves and the possibilities of themselves that they otherwise don't have. And the technique for casting the spell is basically simple, but not simple in its own way. But the way we do it in forest yoga is by breathing, and by breathing with the class, and by breathing in a collective way, which is kind of with the class, but also that the breathing is very hypnotic. So there's a metronomic kind of rhythm to the class and to the breathing and to the delivery of the instructions that cast the spell. And this, Anna said herself, that she said in a testimonial that she gave for me, was she said that, I think that Erica's skill for this in part arises from her musical training.
Yeah, it was just
understanding. Yeah, the understanding that the architecture of a class has to have a narrative arc, but it also has to be compelling in right. a way that pulls people in for the story.
Mm.
And so I think that the musical training like contributes to the way that you create a narrative in a yoga class. But the narrative also in the way that we teach forest yoga isn't about you paying attention to me. Mm-hmm. It's about you paying attention to you.
Mm-hmm.
So the spell, the invitation is, let's get interested in you. And kind of the magic then of the class is that everybody is having their own journey, right? But you're just the facilitator, kind of in the same way that, you know, you might in a sweat lodge. Anna actually calls it sweat lodge yoga, that there's a facilitator. There's an experience that creates this, and then everybody has their own journey. And the journey may be euphoric or the journey may be horrifying, but whatever happens, that the journey is in service of the repair of the human spirit.
Mm.
And the repair of the human spirit is facilitated also by the repair of the human body, and that these two things can't really like be
mm-hmm.
structured, that they have to go together. And that's one of the reasons why yoga is so effective in ways that other things are not, and so effective when it's taught well, because it really is a mind-body practice. But what usually is lost is that the thing that holds together the mind and the body is the breathing, which is why I said the way that you cast the spell is first and foremost by breathing, because that's the thing that pulls together mind, yeah, body. And mm-hmm. if you don't instruct people how to breathe and you don't create a strong container in their breathing, this thing won't happen. And people will go on thinking and never actually make contact with the body. And then the body will continue to be hurt or bereft or whatever. And then the healing, the magic of it doesn't occur. So
that I'm so glad you're touching on the breathing, because I abandoned a yoga practice a long time ago. And I remember when I would get challenged on breathing differently, it was really just this challenge that at the time I felt a little discouraged by, but now I'm like being inspired again to come back, because I think we do really undermine like breathing work for ourselves. And we don't always know what that looks like. It feels like either.
Well, it's slippery.
Yeah.
Foremost. And it's also what you do from the moment that you're born until the moment that you die is breathing.
Hallelujah. Right? Mm-hmm.
So breathing is this thing that's incredibly natural, but right. also incredibly overlooked.
Yes.
So you think about it like a fish in water. If you don't clean the water, the fish suffocates, right? Mm-hmm. And the way that we treat breathing is very similar, is we actually don't take care of our breathing. And then we suffocate, but we don't know that we're suffocating.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So,
right.
You know, when you look at the fish tank and you're like, when did the water get so dirty? You know, it happened a little bit at a time, just a little bit at a time.
Mm.
But also, it's not your fault. What happens is that yoga teachers actually don't teach you how to breathe. Mm-hmm. And that is the primary job. And my teacher, Anna Forrest, I remember her a long time ago saying to me, if you just teach your people to breathe better, you will be doing them an immeasurable service.
Now, is that when are you talking about like Westernized yoga teachers or just because I think there's also that the more Americanized yoga too, at times feels very mathematical, like you talk about in your book. It's approached as more of a science rather than this breathing. Yes, or another type of workout to be measured by, and not to come to a space where the breathing is first and foremost.
Well, I think that. So forest yoga is a Westernized yoga practice, which is why I'm hesitating a little bit.
But it does seem unique. It does seem to stand out compared to other Westernized practices from what I've been able to gather.
Yes. Yes, yeah. It does. And I think that that is because there's pillars in forest yoga, and the pillars are breath, strength, integrity, and spirit. And then there's three more: go deeper, find your truth, live your life off the mat. But the first pillar of forest yoga is breath.
Mm-hmm.
And that is first and foremost what we're teaching is the breath.
Mm-hmm.
And then merging it with the asana, and then finding out how, when you pay attention to your breathing, it changes the way that you work in the poses. So I don't know. I think when you say Westernized, I think you're talking more about sort of like how yoga and fitness have sort of elided.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you for that clarification. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so, but I think that there are still Westernized yoga practices that haven't turned into fitness practices.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm thinking
for sure.
About
yeah.
But the breath and teaching the breath is very difficult. So I just want to give all the yoga teachers that don't teach the breath like a free pass. It's actually very difficult. And so, because you have to constantly be exploring it yourself, but it's this ephemeral thing like water is to a fish.
Mm-hmm.
So to keep studying it and keep finding out how it's working in your body is tricky. So for instance, let me tell you a story. So this morning I was working with a student over Zoom like this, and she picked up with me in part because she's, you know, quarantined at home and working at home, and she's a yoga practitioner, but she's also become very disconnected from her body because she's gained a lot of weight. And that often happens to people. They'll gain weight, and then they are the word that she used is repulsed by themselves. And so that there's this rupture that's created because you've rejected the body. Sure. It's not acceptable to you. Mm-hmm. Anyway, but what I found when I invited her to practice and to create this relationship with her body that is friendly, I invited her to select an attitude to practice with. And I offered her patience, generosity, curiosity, or kindness. Like, which one of those energies to practice with felt compelling to her? And she chose patience. Okay. So
it's lovely.
Yeah. So she chose patience. So then the narrative of the practice was investigating how patience shows up in your breathing and in the way that you practice. Mm. And the first thing that I asked her to do was to take her time to breathe in fully and to breathe out fully. Mm-hmm. Because that is an energetic manifestation of patience in your own breath. Mm-hmm. Right? If you give yourself the time to breathe in all the way and then breathe out all the way, and then don't do it once, right? Because you know, like when you're with your kids, you're like patient for a second and then you stop being patient, then it doesn't count anymore. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, oh, well, now you're not patient. So it doesn't matter that you were patient for 5 minutes. Hmm? Mm-hmm. And it's the same way with your body. It's, you can't like do one breath and be like, okay, that was patient for what you have to do it. You have patience.
It's a commitment. There's a commitment there.
Commitment.
Yeah.
And what she found was that that was difficult and mm-hmm. that she felt like she was getting stuck mm-hmm. around completing the inhale and completing the exhale. Mm. And so just that very, very simple instruction showed her that she was not being patient with herself on a very deep level. And this is the mm-hmm. thing about the breath, is the breath is so sensitive that you can just talk about it and it starts to shift.
Yeah. Oh, big time.
It's so sensitive. But you can work the other way with it, is you can alter it, and then it will open a door to your deeper self and show you something about your deeper self that you were otherwise unaware of, like this particular client was.
That's possible.
Yeah. And so do you, please.
Well, I'm just so curious. And I know that, you've shared your story in your book, and I know you've shared your story in other podcasts, and I can only imagine how you've intimately shared your story with your students. And I don't know if people that, you know, have a certain platform where they're teachers and telling their story. This gets old, but it's a huge part of who you are and how you got to be here today. Sharing these tools, really, really powerful, life-changing tools with people. And if you would be so willing to just like share with us if you could share with us those really profound moments where you had these shifting moments, these life-changing experiences with you, yourself, alone, in your body, in Erica, mm-hmm. and how that came to be, and how the story of yoga was a tool for you to kind of find that part of you.
Sure. Yeah. And it never gets boring. And, you know, this is something that when you, if you are looking to build a platform, I urge you to carefully evaluate what it is that you feel like you could talk about for the rest of your life in some way, shape, or form and not get bored.
Totally. Yeah.
Yeah.
So this was Margaret, that's a great question, you know, and I will, but I just went aside, like, as I thought about what I wanted to teach on, part of the selection was what can I feel is going to be useful for people forever. And not just a fad, not like, oh, here's the latest fad, you know, but here is something sustaining,
timeless,
talk about forever. So it's not boring to me, and I'm happy to tell. So the story is, let me see if I can collapse 20 years into like, you know, five minutes or something. But the narrative arc, I think, is how did I go from not liking myself and my body to liking myself? And the hesitation is around selecting the language, because I think that there is a spectrum along which everybody exists that has so many words. And at the very most terrible end of the spectrum is hate. And the most wonderful end of the spectrum is accept unconditionally or love unconditionally. And in between those two points is a myriad of words that could describe how you feel about your body. And that
in like an hour.
And you could slide across that in the space of 30 seconds. Right. So just because you've had the experience of unconditional love for your body doesn't mean that you will not slide back into hatred in the next 5 minutes. And that is very confusing. It's a very confusing experience for humans.
Yes. Yeah.
So the hesitation was around what is the narrative of the journey of me going from disliking. I'll say dislike because I feel like hate can be maybe hyperbolic, but it also can be very upsetting to other people, right? Mm-hmm. So we'll go with dislike into, I would say that I firmly exist in the realm of accepting. Mm-hmm. I think that I can say, like, I live in the world of accepting pretty constantly, day to day, right? And so how did that happen? Well, first of all, there was the entrance into yoga, and the entrance into yoga happened because I have adult onset migraine headaches, and I started getting them in my mid-20s, and it was shattering because I went from being like healthy, what I thought it was healthy. I'm putting healthy in air quotes for all your listeners who can't see the air quotes. I'm putting healthy in air quotes because I thought I was healthy, and in retrospect, I realized I was not healthy. So it's going from healthy to sick, very sick overnight. And it was recommended to me that I go to yoga because yoga was going to like relax me, or, you know, I don't know really, but so I went to yoga, and in yoga, and I'll spare you sort of the sampling all the yoga lineages stories, and just say in forest yoga, what I found was that I was very mean to myself. And I think that
within your practice, like as you were practicing, that was something that you were aware of in your practice as an observer, was that your thoughts were, you were being mean as you were practicing?
I was being mean as I was practicing, but the practice was just a spotlight.
It
was
it shined on
who you are, basically. Sure. So I was mean to myself. I was mean to my body with the way that I treated my body, but I was also mean to my body in terms of what I thought about it while I was doing this. So there's the externalities, like how do you treat your body? And there's the internalities. Is that a word? Internality. It is now. There's the internalities of what are you doing all the time? And Anna Forrest calls the ways that we beat ourselves up inside with our thoughts, she calls it self-mutilation. Like if you put it on the outside, it would be no different than cutting yourself with a razor blade all day, every day, right? But that's what people do inside with their thoughts. So I discovered in my yoga practice that I was very mean to myself. And I had always thought that the meanness was justified because I was tall and fat and ugly, right? And so people are mean to themselves because they feel that they are undeserving of anything better.
Mm.
And I had, you know, I had this misconception about myself. And so I figured that I was deserving of all that meanness. And then my teacher suggested otherwise. The teacher suggested that the body was deserving of kindness just because.
Mm-hmm.
Just because it existed.
And that's new for you.
Mm-hmm. That was totally new for me. And it was totally new that the body...
Yeah, you didn't have to earn that.
Correct.
Which is what we're taught. We're taught that we have to earn rest, joy, kindness,
yes,
respect.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not actually... The real travesty of that... Yeah. Is that then we're not only are we taught that we have to earn it, but we're actually not taught what it looks or feels like. Kindness, generosity, respect, rest. We don't know what it is, so that when it's that here, you get it. You're like, oh, great. And you're never taught to discern, like, no, actually, that's not respect.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
So interesting. Yeah. Right? It's like respect is this thing that one day you'll get, and when you get it, it's actually not it.
Yes. Yeah.
So, yeah. So I learned in my forest yoga classes that the body was deserving of kindness and curiosity and respect just because, but also because, and this was sort of the cosmology that was built in that I didn't understand at the time, but also the message was that because, as my Latin teacher would have said at Madison West High School, as Patrick Frawley would have said, because you are a child of God.
Shut up.
he had a little Tourette, so he would like hit himself as he said it.
yeah.
But that because that you are deserving of this because you are a manifestation of the spirit in all things.
Mm.
That's it.
Did you buy it?
I did. Well, I didn't initially. Look, it's real. It takes a lot to decondition you from the notion, from what our society does to us, which is, as a friend and author of my, a friend of mine who's also an author said, we had a conversation on Thursday, and she's like, basically, our society is violent towards humans. Our society is anti-human, right? Mm-hmm. And so when you're brought up believing that you need to, you know, you need to look a certain way to even be deserving of respect.
Right.
And then you buy into that because everything tells, why wouldn't you buy
it? Right. Right.
It takes a long time to undomesticate yourself. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And that's basically what's happened is we've all become domesticated to this violent society where it becomes very normal. And so did I believe it? Yes, yes, my spirit believed it because my spirit could hear that was a complete truth.
Hmm.
You know, when you hear something, yes, you're like, that's a complete truth. And you're like, I can buy into that. But then the rest of you is like, takes a long time to catch up.
The conditioned part of you has to,
So, at yoga, I learned that. And then, you know, some of the other pieces I think were moving to New York City where beauty means many different things,
mm-hmm,
right? Where in the Midwest, I think that beauty, was pretty standardized,
mm-hmm,
right? And in New York City, beauty means many things.
I love that about New York City.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. It's incredible.
So yeah. New York City felt to me like summer camp felt to me when I went away to summer camp, you know, where nobody knew you and you could be like crazy and wild and everybody would thought that was cool. And then you go home and everybody like, you'd be shut up in your little box again at home. Right. That's what New York felt like to me when I got here. It was like New York was like summer camp. It was like nobody knew me. I could be whoever I wanted. And I realized in New York City that, in fact, I was not tall, fat, and ugly. I realized that I was tall and curvy and pretty. And those were like radically different descriptors. And so moving to New York City kind of moved the needle on this whole sense of a misperception that I had about myself. But we're taught to have a misperception about ourselves, right? So all of us, men, women, all of us are taught to have a misperception. But New York really sort of did another piece of this sort of thing. And then it moved along the spectrum from I don't like to myself to I'm interested in healing myself to now I'm confused because people are responding to me very differently here than they did at home. And then I realized in complete retrospect that I had had a very deep misconception about myself that I think people responded to me the way that they did all along because I was pretty. And I thought they responded to me to the way that they did because I was ugly. And sometimes people of like Margaret, just the way that you describe me, like, oh, she's that tall, beautiful person.
Yeah.
Changed the energy in the room, right? I think that maybe I always had that magic, but the energy in the room shifted in a way that made me think I had done something wrong.
That's such a reflection of
the energy in the room, whatever I did in the room didn't bring people closer to me. It actually pushed them away. And I think that, you know, what the book tries to do in many ways is tries to encourage everybody to understand themselves in a way that is kind and accepting, but also to understand the impact that you have on other people. And I had never understood the impact that I had on other people. And so that created a misperception. And yeah. I think that the misperception then was that maybe my confidence, which I didn't feel like was confidence at all. But what I realized is confidence is actually the way other people see you. That's what it is. Self-esteem is how you feel about yourself. Confidence is how other people see you. So other people saw confidence for whatever reason.
Which can be triggering for other people. And that can feel intimidating, and it can be right up in your face of like observing somebody that's confident. And then a direct reminder of how you don't feel what you're observing in someone else.
Exactly.
It can be a real mind fuck.
Yep. And that's actually something I talk about in the book is that being yourself unabashedly can actually be triggering for other people.
Yes. This radical acceptance.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. That radical... Great use of the word.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Something that I've experienced personally is anytime, this is what I've come to realize now, I should say, when I look back and I'm kind of evaluating where I stand with myself now currently, anxiety and depression for me really were about how I just kept wanting to go against the grain, so to speak, of that conditioning. And when I would go out there on that limb, right, of that radical acceptance, and you touch on it too as embodiment, Erica, which I love. When you're really being embodied, you're also taking such a risk because a lot of people in their own conditioning with their own pain and all their own experiences don't know how to accept it.
Yes.
And so it's almost like, is this even worth the risk? I mean, I'm anxious and depressed over here, but I want to be out there and people don't know how to see me out there. And you almost have to learn to just be like, I got to hang out over there though. Because.
Yeah. Or I'm going to say, and we'll use or as the inclusive. And I think that on the arc of what you're talking about, Andrea, it would be two things. Is one is also building your resiliency.
Mm-hmm.
Is that pretty loud?
Oh, it's lovely. No.
Okay. Because now it's like five.
Police departments. Because there's nothing you can do about it.
No, nothing I can do about it. Can't be like, I'm recording a podcast. Be quiet. But so back to the topic. I think maybe this is helpful to you, maybe helpful to the listeners, is as you think about, like, I really want to live over there, which is I want to be myself.
I want to be embodied. Yeah.
I want to be embodied, mm-hmm. which is like being feeling free, feeling safe to be yourself is really mm-hmm. sort of what being embodied is. Feeling safe to be yourself. Is that there's two things. Is one is like build your tribe. Like build the people who you know you can do that with. And at first it might be totally. One person. Or then it's maybe four or five. And then what that does is it builds your resiliency, right? So that when you go out and you feel like, oh, I'm getting some pushback, that you can handle the pushback, right? Mm-hmm. But also you can handle the pushback in a way that disarms the people who want to push back,
mm-hmm.
right? So you feel like, mm-hmm. oh, I'm getting pushback because they feel uncomfortable that I'm comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then the empathy around that kind of diffuses the situation and sort of, right. instead of you feeling you got pushed back. So you go into feeling uncomfortable and defensive and maybe pushing back. It's like your resiliency is enough that you can see like, oh, I've made other people uncomfortable by being me,
mm-hmm.
which has nothing to do with me being me.
That's why I love the line that it's essentially this, I accept your perception of me because it's yours. It's not mine. It's not about me. Mm-hmm. And I think there is a lot of empathy mm-hmm. from that standpoint. And to be more embodied by that position now is so freeing. It's a beautiful place to be. And
yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like you said, you can slide around on that spectrum still. But you know how to come back to where you want to be more and more and more. And that's what it's all about.
Practice of resiliency and centering.
Yeah.
Resiliency and centering, but also self-compassion. Because you know that it's going to change.
Mm-hmm.
You don't stay in one place for too long, hopefully.
Right. Right. Right.
And there's this incredible phenomenon that the bodies that we're walking around in are going to go through these enormous changes, right? So it's right. like, great, lovely. We did all this really ugly work in our 20s. Maybe we got to our 30s. We're a little bit more comfortable with ourselves. It's not so terrible to look in the mirror anymore. Maybe it's okay. But then there we go. And then it's like, we've got the rest of our lives of this ever-changing body. And you know, I also keep thinking of like this experience for people that carry children and then this transition of the postpartum period and like this mind blowing, this person comes out of you and then you're in this whole new body. I mean, so there's that.
It's very
and then important. There's eight and then there's aging and like this acceptance is just endless mm-hmm. of this journey of being okay.
But Erica, I think what you've done, I think what's incredible about your book is it's so multifaceted to me. And I loved your connection to the history of our existence and how, like, post-industrialized world versus before. You know, everything is connected on all the points there. And that's why I just think, I mean, I've marked it up and highlighted, but that's why it's I just think it's so important to really acknowledge those points that you know, because we can talk for days about all the cultural things that we're working against, you know, but well, we didn't just get here out of nowhere.
No, no.
There's so much that happened. Yeah.
There's a lot that happened, but also it's if you want to talk about the body and reshaping your relationship with it, you have to also understand the past, because
yes,
your body has the best memory, right? Mm. Your body remembers every ancestor you've ever had. Every ancestor you ever had is in your DNA. It remembers everything. And it doesn't just remember it like on a DNA level, but it also remembers it on a cellular level and then on an organ level. And then, so you are a biography, not just of yourself, but of every ancestor you've ever had. And, you know, and horrible things happened to women in the past, and horrible things happened to men in the past, and, mm-hmm. and your body remembers. So I feel like the history is important. And, you know, I don't necessarily point it out in the book that you like that your body remembers everything, mm-hmm. but there is that truth. And go ahead.
Well, I just like, I feel like there's like this overwhelming feeling of like, okay, so now what? So mm-hmm. what do we do with that?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Know? So
right. I mean, I've spent the better part.
What was that? What did you say, Margaret?
Oh, it's a lot to hold.
It is. It is.
Yeah.
It is. Yeah. I've spent the better part of this week journaling about this, like, and I've just come back to the journal a lot about the embodiment. Yeah. And I said that I wrote down that question. What do we do with all this now? Like, yeah.
What do you do with the knowledge or how do you change?
Or just the knowing and like that, the sitting with it.
Yeah.
You know,
well, a few things. One is that's where the embodiment practices are useful and the breathing practices are useful.
Right.
Because the breathing is a way for you to make your container bigger. You can't think your way into a bigger container. You can't. So the breathing practices are really important because the breath can match the volume and the intensity of the sensation and the knowledge, right? Mm-hmm. So what do you do with it? You breathe in order to get bigger for it and to hold it. Because you're like, oh my God, now there's so much to hold. What do I do? Right. Okay. So you breathe. And then the next thing I think is to really feel compassionate for yourself and everything that you are holding and just be like, oh my God, there is like, for as long as there are human beings worth of knowledge in me, holy shit, you know, yeah. And be compassionate for that. And just, and also then slow down, because I think that we're in a society that's like snip, snap. Let's get the answers, people. Let's move along. And it's like, no, you are.
We need space to pause. Yes.
Yeah. And just slow down and be like, I might not solve this in my lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. There might not be a neat little bow on this problem in my lifetime, because what I'm up against is a complete family tree worth of history and trauma and whatever. Okay. Mm-hmm. So I think that those things are really important. And then the what do you do to change? Like, what do you do? So to pivot towards like hope. I know you said hold, Margaret, but I heard mm-hmm. hope. Because it's a lot to hold. And I think that the fact that it's a lot to hold can feel heavy and sad and heartbreaking. Mm-hmm. So I think it's important to pivot like fast to solutions, even at the same time that I said, slow down. And you know, sure. Andrea, when you said there's so much, the book is multifaceted. It's multifaceted in terms of time and history, but also to do this work of pivoting quick from the moment it starts to feel like too much, to pivot to like something hopeful or something to do or a strategy or a tip.
Yeah, and the book has prompts and practices that are really helpful too, which I think is important for listeners to hear.
I also want to give some stuff right now for your listeners. Can we do that?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay.
Go ahead. Yeah.
No, what were you going to say?
Well, I was going to say that what I appreciate about the embodiment piece is you pointing out that there is pain to accept when you're doing that. And you know, embodiment isn't this space where you're just like, la, 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 la. It's like, no, it's actually being embodied means you take all, you accept all of it. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that I think about that as like chapter 5 in the book, where chapter 5 really gets down to the nitty gritty of embodiment. And I think that chapter 5 does some great work, which is basically acknowledging that there will be pain, acknowledging that this is not going to be comfortable
at all.
At all. And oh God, that sounds like a great sales pitch. So why should I do this? And then
because you'll feel better, right? Right.
Yeah, you're going to, well, then you're going to feel better, but also the promise is that you get to have some benefits, right? If you do this work, you get some benefits. And the benefits are like, are having a better relationship with your body has some immediate outcomes in terms of your health. Right.
I was thinking about that very thing.
We're in the middle of a pandemic, right? We're in the middle of a pandemic, and what's been revealed is that most people have pretty shoddy health regimes. And they have pretty shoddy health regimes because they haven't taken the time to actually get to know their body. Right. So the immediate benefits of it is that you get to know your body, and then you can have some better health. And this is a huge thing that, you know, basically chapter 5, 6, and 7 are how do you actually take care of your body and the thing that lives in it on its own terms. But absent the book, which what I usually teach is what I call my 5 adoring core competencies. And these are benchmarks that people can use to assess how am I doing in my relationship with my body? Because what people want is they want to know that it's getting better, right? So the benchmarks are basically the 5 areas, and I'll tell you them kind of like real quick. So the areas are injury, illness, and aging. How you doing in your relationship with those things? And then the next area is weight. How are you doing in your relationship with your weight?
Or size. Would you also just parentheses size?
Or yes. Yeah. Weight and size.
Yeah, good call.
Tall girls.
I don't know what
For tall girls. Yeah. Or short girls. Because you know what? When you're short, when you're an itty bitty, what happens is people don't take you seriously. They treat you like a child. Right. Cause they're like, she's tiny. She must not know anything. It's like, what does being tiny have to do with knowing anything? You look like a child, therefore you might. It's like, no, I can be 5 foot and be an adult. How tall are you?
I'm barely 5'3", babe.
Okay, all right. So
I've had a lot of that experience in the world of not being taken very seriously.
So whether you're tall or small, your relationship with your weight or your size, that's great. I really should update this to include size.
Yeah, good call on that one.
Yeah,
because I mean, because some of us, it's like
there's no scale.
The bones just, there's no scale.
Yeah,
like why do I need a? You know, for me, it's taken a while, but I have been off a scale for probably 20 years. I'm sure that there was a time that I was like on that scale for, you know, 3 times a day or something bizarre. And so for me, the weight is, you know, but size or shape or form. Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Keep going. This is great. I love this list.
Yeah. And then adoring core competency number 3 is thoughts and speech, which is how you think about yourself and how you talk about yourself. because it's
that is enormous.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and then area number four is around food, right? Because food is, you know, the primary way that we regulate our relationship to weight or size. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And then adoring core competency number five is around movement and touch.
Mm.
And I want to grab a pen. Can I grab a pen real quick?
Absolutely. Okay,
cool. Yeah.
That's so important. I want to take a sweat. You know, you just help me. You just help me update my info.
You got it.
And then I'm going to put size and shape. Super important. And then another thing that I've been thinking about including in movement and touch is also breath, but breath is a little esoteric in terms of like a benchmark. People understand movement and touch more easily, but really what movement and touch are about is like, what is the primary language of the body? Because the body doesn't speak English, right? So the languages of the body are basically like movement, touch, and breath, but breath is the first language it knows because that's how the body becomes alive, is through breathing.
Erica, every time you say breath, I just take a really big deep breath.
It's like Kegel. It's like you can't say Kegel
without squeeze.
I'm just like,
squeeze.
You know? So
it actually vibrates, it actually invigorates your energy right away just to squeeze.
Yes. Can we all just take a moment and squeeze?
Just really squeeze.
Instead of like, let's all just ground it.
Take a moment to like squeeze.
Just feel our inhale and.
So back to the areas of competency. So, and this is sort of to your question, like for your listeners who want something they can do like immediately, like these are some areas where you can evaluate how's this relationship going? Because these are the manifestations in behavior of a relationship. And a relationship is basically, you have a friendship, and a friendship is manifest through instances of relating that then produce like outcomes. Yeah. Yeah. So a relationship always has outcomes that are generated through instances of relating. So you can go, how is my relationship with my body going based on how do I treat it around injury, illness, or aging? Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So some of the tips are like, I mean, and here we are, it's like when we're all in a injury illness, we're in an illness crisis, whether you're sick or not, we're all right now during COVID being made to assess our relationship with being sick or the potential of being sick or even the specter of death. And it's been really interesting because really the end of this is injury, illness, aging, and death. And I usually don't talk about it because it makes people freaked out, but that's where it's goes. Like, right. Is the way that you treat your body when it's sick is a tiny incarnation of the way that you will treat your body as you approach death, right? Mm-hmm. And the way that you treat your body when it's injured is also evident of how you are going to treat your body as you approach death. And, and we'd all like to have, I think we all would like to have a good death, huh?
Yeah.
So
it's going to be lovely.
It's going to be great, yeah? So maybe you don't want to die on a ventilator. Nobody wants to die on a ventilator, right? But you can think about it like how I treat myself when I'm sick is a little bit of how am I going to exit this plane, yeah?
Hmm.
And when you're injured, it's like a lot of times when people are injured, they do the least to take care of their body. Have you noticed that?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. They're like, you're like, they sprain, you sprain an ankle and it's like, well, have you done anything? You're like, nah. It's like, well, have you tried elevating it? I don't have time. It's like, okay, well.
then I don't want to hear about it. That's what I tell my kids. When they come to me with an ailment, I go over the list and I have a headache. Okay, have you had a glass of water? No. Do you need some food? I don't know. Like, why don't you go lay down? I don't know. It's like, well, if you're not willing to take a little bit of time to take care of yourself, then I'm not really willing to hear about your ailments. Like, there needs to be some sense of responsibility.
Yeah.
Of ourselves.
And yes. And that's a basic fundamental, how do you relate to your body specifically?
Mm-hmm.
Specifically. And the thing is a lot of times people aren't taught to take care of their bodies when they're injured. And they don't know how. They don't know how to make the determination, should I put my foot up or not? Is the headache bad enough that I should take some medicine? We don't know how, because we actually don't have a relationship with our body in the first place.
And we've been so encouraged to be disembodied.
Yes.
That we lose the sight of just that, like, more of that inner wisdom of tuning in and listening.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And it really shows up, right? The rupture in the relationship shows up when we're injured, ill, or when we are confronted with our own aging.
Gosh, I've never thought about that before. Yeah, that's really good.
Yeah, so it shows up. And then those are little, like, spikes. There are little spikes in your relationship where you can see, like, this is going well or this is not going well. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Injury, illness. Like I think actually this COVID thing is in many ways a great recalibration about how to be sick, right? Because how many times is it that you would be sick and just push through and go to work, right? Mm-hmm. Everybody does that. But that's also because our workplace environment is hostile to people who don't work.
Yes.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right. So our society has been set up in a anti-human way, in a push-through way. Like, it doesn't matter that you're sick, you go to work. No, it actually does matter that you're sick. Now it's framed as don't get other people sick, but it should have been framed as take care of yourself, which is a kindness to yourself and a kindness to others.
Therefore, and others, yes.
Yeah. I heard recently just a beautiful quote just pertaining to COVID. I think that it's, you know, applies to this conversation a little bit. That crisis is a terrible thing to waste, and how much we are learning from this about Erica, as you pointed out earlier, how we all have kind of shoddy self-care patterns and behaviors, and this is an opportunity for us to really, you know, get a good view at a lot of things in our lives.
So many.
Micro, macro, all of it.
Mm-hmm. So it's been revealed that we're terrible at being sick, and we are terrible at being sick. We're terrible at the specter of sickness. We're terrible at just the basic handling of it. So we have had an opportunity to get better at it, which is going to make everybody, I think, get better at taking care of their bodies. Yeah. And then around aging, it's like, I mean, aging is this huge topic in and of itself that is very, very, very triggery for women in many ways. But suffice it to say, we're all getting older together. So it's not personal, even though we all take it really personally. Mm-hmm. And can we reframe aging? And that's sort of where I'm going to leave it now.
Yeah.
Can we just reframe aging as...
Yes, we can.
Yes,
we can.
Please.
And that is its own topic, but it's just, you know, let's reframe, and then there will be a course on aging reframe. Should I keep going?
Sounds great. Yes, this is lovely.
Erica, I have a question. Do you, or maybe just to get your thoughts, do you think part of this personal responsibility of kind of, you know, reclaiming your own embodiment, this whole journey of being embodied and what that means, because there's layers to that. But because there is, you know, there is the systems that have been created in our industrialized world, merely just to, or not merely, but like purely to just capitalize on us hating ourselves. And part of being responsible in this journey is to do a lot of pushing back on it. Do you want to share any thoughts about that? I mean, your book, again, the book has, you guys just get the book.
Just get the book, read the book.
But, you know, we have social media now that's playing a big part in all of this as well. Or it's added like another layer.
I think it's made it more difficult. I mean, are you asking?
Well, because there's the beauty industry, right? The beauty industry that targets like it all. It's all about youth. It's all about how do you just maintain
be
that
young for
the with which is also very limitedly defined youth too.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to get to like, there's just multiple structures in place that are mm-hmm. literally banking on us continuing to be disembodied and hate, dislike, have a sheer distaste for our bodies.
I mean, I think the answer is to educate yourself, and reading the book is a form of education, and then to make choices around what beauty regimes you invest in and why, and make sure that it is springing from love and not hate. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think a real big reframe is like
that reframe. Can, yeah. Yeah.
You can put on makeup out of love and enjoyment and playfulness and artistry. Like for some people, makeup
totally.
Artistry, right?
Yeah.
Or you just like put on an outfit. Part of their outfit. Yeah. Or you can put on makeup because you don't like the way you look. And then there's like something in between, which is like that you might feel more you might have better self-esteem if you are presenting yourself in a particular way.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a very subtle, like you'd have to discern. It requires discernment. Like, is the motivation for that hatred? Like, I hate the way I look, or is the motivation?
Is it a celebration? Yeah.
I feel better when I, like, for instance, like acne, like there's a movement on social media where people who have cystic acne, like don't cover up their acne.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, this is the way my skin is. This is just right. And that for them is incredibly like liberating. Just be like, well, my skin mm-hmm. looks like this, and I am accepting the way my skin looks, right? And that could be an arc of healing and recovery, is to fully accept. And then there could be a next step or a prior step, I don't really know, which could be like, actually, I accept my acne, and I also wear makeup because I feel better about myself when I present like this.
Mm-hmm.
But if I took off my makeup, it wouldn't be like, oh my God, embarrassing. Does that make sense?
It does. It does. It reminds me of, well, for one, the reframe part is crucial. Like you're saying, just that leaning into how you want to reframe things for yourself and understanding where it's coming from.
Or yeah. Your intention. I kept thinking
about the intention.
Like, it's my intention for mm-hmm. making these choices of like going on this beauty, whatever, you know, like what's mm-hmm. the intention behind it?
Yeah. You know, one of my friends in this sort of body acceptance realm, she runs a program that's called Lose Hate, Not Weight.
Mm, that's beautiful.
And I think that's a really snappy little way to put it. It's like lose hate, not, you know, and in her world, it's weight because she's fat, right? And fat as like a body type descriptor, right?
Not a negative.
No.
Right.
Right. Right. Gosh.
So, and that I realized, like a lot of people have a different, a lot of people are in different places where of their acceptance of the word fat as a descriptor or fat as derogatory. But this particular person, I'm using it because she would self-describe as fat in the same way that she would self-describe as a person of color, right? It's the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So she's saying lose hate, not weight, but it could just as easily be like lose hate, not dislike the shape of your nose. You know, not the shape of your nose, or lose hate, not being short. You know, you could fill in. It's like instead. So the motivator, the wellspring of the behavior, where does the behavior spring from? I think is very important, and you can always use that. No matter how you're engaging with our society, and capitalism isn't going away as far as I can tell. Right. So you can use that as a motivator. Am I interested in this self-improvement, however you want to put it, because I dislike myself, or am I interested in self-improvement because I love myself? And use that kind of, and that's going to be difficult to answer. And it might be like, they're not distinct poles, just the same way, you know,
mutually exclusive. Am I correct. Right, Andrea? Yes. They're not mutually exclusive. This is a new phrase from your lexicon, and Andrea's really done a sweet job of holding my hand to help me understand what it means.
mutually exclusive. Yeah, they're not.
I think that's a great point. Yes, that self-love and self-hate are not mutually exclusive. You can experience them both at the same time. Which is incredibly confusing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Something that I find empowering as it relates to the capitalism point is seeking out people who want to provide products for all people that are products that are about empowerment and not about and beauty. Are not rooted in just like you should change this about you, use this, so to speak.
Yeah,
there are lots of lots of things have popped up now that are they're presented to the customer as like, I don't know, just more
inclusive,
more love for your body, like more for around like healthy body language, healthy body image.
And I think that's in part because of a drive for inclusivity from from a social justice standpoint, but
yeah.
I think also that capitalists have realized that more and more of the marketplace, for instance, is not a size 8. And so, so if you want to sell your product, you might have to actually market to people who have a bigger size. So it's not entirely altruistic, I have to say. But there are people behind those brands, and a lot of them do care about the people who are like the people who are consuming it.
Yeah, new generation, a new wave.
I would love to get back to this list.
Yeah,
I was really on the roll, and then we went off. But now, if we could get back on,
we're going to get back on it. So, but this is relevant. It's a good segue because the next competency is on weight, or size and shape. And certain things are about your size and your shape are never going to change unless you get stretched on a rack or you lose a limb. You're probably
going to get a nose job.
Yeah. Right. So, but when I put this together, you know, I really was thinking weight. So this is sort of gonna go more towards weight, but I mean, really the tip is, when it comes to the shape or the size or the weight of the body, is to become curious about your own body and what it's doing. Because here's the thing, is we all behave like we know a lot about our bodies, but we don't know anything about our bodies. How did your body make that baby?
Multiple times.
Who knows?
They're just shaking their heads.
Magic.
You got me.
Magic.
Magic.
So here's the thing is that we're human beings are very susceptible to selective reasoning. And the selective reasoning basically kind of goes like this. Because you've been taught that your body is a machine, anytime that you think that you can get it to behave like a machine, you will, until you can't. And then you just give up. You just throw your hands up in the air. So case in point, we've been taught that our body functions like a machine when it comes to calories. And this is very pervasive. Calories in, calories out. And if people, it makes me want to pull my hair out when people say calories in, calories out. I'm sorry, it's not that simple. First of all, a female body that is in an estrogen part of its cycle will treat calories differently than a body that is in its progesterone cycle. Okay. Secondly, your body,
that's huge, everybody.
Yeah. Secondly, your body deals with what you put into it differently, depending on whether you're happy or sad, because your body has a different chemistry going on in it when you're happy than it does when it's sad. So the way that you process food is different when you're relaxed than when you're stressed, right? You know that intuitively. You can feel that. If you know,
totally.
It's hard to sit down and eat a meal when you're angry at the person you're eating it with.
Yeah.
Impossible. You're like, I can't do this. I cannot eat. Because you know that that food will go in and your body will be like, no way. We're busy doing other things right now. We're not dealing with right now. We're angry right now. And that takes every single cell in our body to be angry. So anyway, the point is that you think that your body functions like a machine until you can't explain something like how to make a baby. And then you just throw your hands up. But here's the thing. Your body is magical and inexplicable all the time. And you've been duped into thinking that it's a machine when it's convenient to think that it's a machine. You can't be like, it's a machine over here, but magical over there.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I hear this.
Selective reasoning and selective logic in humans, and we are all at fault.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Guilty. Guilty.
Yeah, all of us, because you're human. That's so mm-hmm. Don't take it personally. It's not your fault that you were born a human, no more than it is that your cat was born a cat, or your dog was born a dog, or that squirrel was born a squirrel. It's not your fault. It's just what happened. And so the tip is here. It is to just get really curious about what it means to be human and what it means, what your body's doing, and assume that you don't know, and learn about its biology, anatomy, and functioning as if your body was literally an alien.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Helpful?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, cool.
Yes.
Should I keep going?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Let's wrap up the
list. So the next thing on the list, the core competencies. The core competency number three is around thoughts and speech. So,
I did a little whoop whoop. When you said the first time, I was like, yeah. And like how you talk about yourself, is that kind of where that?
Well, it's so many things. It's basically. The origin is of everything is the way that you think about it. Mm-hmm. And one of the points that I make in the book is that your body isn't really the problem. It's what you think about your body that's the problem. And you can change your relationship if you change the way you think about it. And and for the most part, we're all very mean to ourselves. I think I'm not alone in that. I think that people who are like, no, I'm nice to myself. It's like, good. You are an outlier. Just know that you're an outlier. For the most part, human beings are mean to themselves. I would say women are mean to themselves. Men, probably less so, but more and more men all the time, I think, because they are part of...
Or it just shows up differently. I mean, you can look all around. It's all around us.
Yeah.
It's all around. Male oppression. It's all here.
Yeah. So
we're all hurting.
We're all hurting. So the thing is... we think badly and talk badly about ourselves, but we also do the same thing to other people. So the tip is that the corrective is just to become an admirer of people in general. And I know that probably as parents that you are in admiration of your children at the same time that you're like, at the same time you're like, well, that needs fixing. But, you know, remember when they were infants and you were like, oh my God, they're amazing.
Yeah. They still do that to me. It's different. They still do that to me where I'm just,
So, to be in admiration of other people, I think, is very helpful. And I am in an extraordinary position of privilege to be able to do that, because as a yoga teacher, I see a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And the orientation of forest yoga is to view people as mystery, and as mystery, and as
I love that
manifestation of the divine. And so to always be like, I am looking at the deep mystery of the universe right now in human form. Mm-hmm. And then to be amazed. And so part of the really beautiful thing about my job was because I don't see a lot of people now, but in my 15 years of teaching yoga in New York City, I've like seen literally like thousands of people. And I have just been with every class been immersed in this, which is like, look at all this beauty. It's amazing. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. So I have had a lot of practice in looking for beauty purposefully. And so it's a little shift when you're dealing with people is to be like, look for beauty. And it's hard sometimes when you're in a relationship with them, but you can take a moment in your day just to be like, I'm going to look for the beauty everywhere. And it changes you. And so if you are looking for beauty, if you're in admiration of other people, it also is good medicine for you, because it's running that energy through you. And then it may be easier to turn it around on yourself and just look for mm-hmm. the beauty in yourself.
Mm-hmm. That was totally lovely.
Thank you. Should I keep going?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So the next thing is food. The next thing is food. Okay. So food is tricky, because we've been taught that there's good food and there's bad food. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, and we die if we don't eat it. So real, that's, you know.
Yeah, and it can become an addiction. And unlike other addictions, you will not be able to live if you just quit.
You have to figure it out. You have to, I mean, you don't have to figure it out, but you're right. It's not like, I'm just going to stop doing crack. I'm going to just, you know. This is here with us.
Yeah. So I wholeheartedly believe that once we've developed an honest relationship with our bodies, that you will be able to figure out what to eat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So,
and I think I think in addition to that, if I may,
please
add on that it's about what to eat and how to eat.
Absolutely.
Like what space we're in, when we eat, if we choose to make it a priority to, or if I find value in being in a good mindset when we eat,
chewing thoroughly.
That was a big thing with my Italian grandmother, masticate. And also like having some practice around gratitude with your food and having some pause about where is it coming from, all of the things that this morsel had to go through to get to my mouth. I mean, and just having some pause and some gratitude in that. So I think it's in addition to like what all the choices that we have, it's also our relationship with how we feel when we're putting it in our bodies.
Yes. And I'm making a note because I just want to note that on my sheet. And I, so much as with the spectrum of how people feel about their bodies, they will be at a certain point in their recalibration of their relationship with food. And I think that usually the first step is to break up with diet culture. That's usually the first step. Mm-hmm. And then the second step is to create a relationship with the body to figure out what the body wants. Mm-hmm. So there is no good, there is no bad, right? But this is going to create a circle. So stay with me and wait for it. And then... And then, so there is no good, there is no bad. And then you get to some of the practices that you're talking about, which I think are high level practices. Like for a person who's just breaking up with diet culture, how you eat your food and raking your food or chewing thoroughly might be mm-hmm. advanced.
Yeah. I mean, if you've had such a long time of being anxious around food, like with guilt, there's guilt, there's the diet culture that's constantly trying to mm-hmm. be in our world.
It's, or just disordered eating, just eating in a self-abusive way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. Whether it's binging or restricting, it mm-hmm. can go all, it can go all directions, binging, purging, restricting, all of those. So there's many steps and we're not going to, I'm seeking to encapsulate it quickly mm-hmm. for your listeners, because sometimes things that we say when we're on a certain level of the path can either be like incomprehensible to a person or triggery.
Sure.
Right?
Totally.
Mm-hmm. Right? So I'm trying to encapsulate an arc as fast as I can mm-hmm. so that a person could hear a complete cycle.
Yeah.
So there'll be like break up with diet culture, create a new relationship with your body so that you can figure out what to eat. Breaking up with diet culture sort of also encapsulates, contending with disordered eating and eating disorders, because diet culture is basically what instigates all of that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then there's the like, how do I eat? When do I eat? How much do I eat? All of that kind of coming into recalibration. There is no good food. There is no bad food. But as you contend with that, you might decide that sugar isn't great for you. Mm-hmm. Right?
Right, which is where the reframe on restriction can come in, which comes from this. This is coming from a love for my body now.
Correct.
So the restriction on this is really healthy and really full of merit, because I'm listening now.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And that good and bad don't mean you can eat this, you can't eat this, but maybe legitimately sugar isn't great for you.
Yeah.
And so it's not about diet culture telling you you can't eat sugar. It's about the legitimacy that sugar is not great for your body. But wait for it.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Just keep waiting for it. Because if you're listening and you're getting angry or triggered mm-hmm. over this notion, just wait for it. But then there's another curve to this circle, and it curves back in on itself, which is that it matters how you eat what you eat. So if you eat sugar joyfully, it's going to have a different impact than if you eat sugar because you're tired and anxious. Yeah. So mm-hmm. your body responds to what you put into it, what's good or bad, or arguably sugar is not good for you. But if you're eating sugar with joy, there's going to be a different response from your body, right? Than if you're eating sugar mm-hmm. because you're tired and
anxious or upset. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then wait for it, because the circle keeps turning. The universe doesn't care what you eat. It doesn't make you good or bad. So mm-hmm. you could eat dog food for the rest of your life and be enlightened. And you could eat a really pristine diet and be a terrible person. So at the end of the day, good and bad and diet culture all kind of loops back on itself. And the universe doesn't care what you eat. Mm-hmm. And then we're back. You're like, does it matter what you eat? I don't know. Mm-hmm. Maybe not. And this is where the dietitians are going to lose their minds. They're going to be like, no, you can't eat sugar. And I'm like, yes, that's true. From a certain vantage point, a Diet Coke is not good for you. I would say the Diet Coke is empty of significance, but the corporation that made the Diet Coke, definitely bad for you. You know, mm-hmm. all the energy in the Diet
Coke
is it's really to destroy you. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. But then you could take that energy of like, of our anti-human society just pumping you full of chemicals and sugar and you know,
crap, right,
all of that, and you could just completely neutralize it by drinking it with joy.
This is going to be a little like, I yeah. think, for...
So a little... This is bad. And for those of you that are listening that feel like this is a stretch, it's okay.
It is okay.
It's okay.
We're all it where is okay. we're at, and... You know, it's just, that's the beauty of the human plethora is we get to, there's just like so many incredible ways to view this journey. I yeah. know I'm dating a farmer. I'm dating, you know, and I'm like, she's going to say, no, it matters. It matters what you eat. It matters where your food comes from. It matters. And
it does matter.
You know, it does. It does.
That's the thing. It does. But this doesn't take away from that mattering. That's the thing.
Yeah.
You know? And so.
Right.
And so it's almost like, it's like, I'm going to take the power back. This is my power that I get to have. And if I want that one fucking Diet Coke and I'm going to enjoy it, then let it be what that, then let it be what it is. I think we do really undermine, the energy, that energetic level.
I always get a big craving for a DC at the movie theater with that popcorn. And it does that like weird chemical thing, the popcorn and the DC. Like,
that really it's not butter that they put on it, but it's so delicious. Why is popcorn so delicious? Because it's covered in chemicals that aren't butter. But there's something in my brain and my brain just lights up. Yeah. I mean, so yeah, it
but
does
to be
that.
Empowered is a big, it's a big energy shift when you're taking the power back.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I mean, okay, then back to the corporations that make the food. Does it matter where your food comes from? Yes, because people are affected.
Yes.
In that, time. Right? So so you're dating a farmer and he is part
she.
She. I was like, wait a minute. Just massive assumption. I was like, don't do that. She you know, he, I was going to say he or she, but thank you. Like
she might not care, but she,
yeah, but she, right. Like she is part of a system that affects humans.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. I think huge. More than anything, big actually, time. The food big systems time. Affect humans, like mm-hmm. how the food is made, where it's made, where it goes, what it's made into, how much it costs.
It is. It will impact our health. Yeah.
All of it.
And I think this is another one of, as of course we know, and I know I'm preaching to the choir, but again, this quote around COVID, like crisis is a terrible thing to waste, and just how many things, as we know, are really being exposed right now. And our systems is a big one.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Big one.
Food is a huge one.
Among many others.
Food is huge. Mm-hmm. So on that note, should we go to the last adoring core competency?
Yes.
Okay. Just movement and touch, because the language of your body is not English. Your body doesn't speak English. It speaks movement and touch. So if you want to make a relationship, right? You got to make a relationship that is founded on languages that your friend understands.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to make a relationship with your body, you know, here's some core competencies, but sort of at the very basis, most basic level is how do you move and how do you touch? Because that's what your body understands. And what I've discovered from watching many people move.
Yeah.
That they are not nice in the way that they move. Right. So some of the things are like be gentle, you know, like move smoothly, move intelligently, pay attention to the impact of what you do on your body.
Yeah. You mean like only approaching it with a lot of calculation, like exercise calculation, or
movement can be anything. Movement can be exercise. It can be dance. It could be throwing a pot. It could be walking from here to the door. It could be how do you sit at the computer. Any kind of movement. Does that help?
I think I was trying to ask, like, you mean try to not have it just be about that, like, calculated exercise movement?
Yes. So movement,
because more and more recently, in recent years, especially learning to live in a home, because I love how you frame that, Erica. It's your spirit's home. It's the shore to your ocean. I love that. Mm-hmm. And I feel like I want to be like a kid again when I want to move in a way that feels so good.
And free.
Just the dancing and the playing and the wrestling and the jumping. It's like, it's movement that feels really, really right. You know, like really, really grounded. I don't know how to, but.
Mm-hmm. Well, when we were children, we were free, right?
Oh, yeah.
So, and we were free in our bodies. So yeah.
And I've asked friends recently, I ask them more and more now, do you move? Do you ever just move? That doesn't mean like I'm on this power walk right now, but like, it's just movement for yourself. Like you just try to feel like that kid again, you know?
And for some people that can be a big ask because they don't feel that sort of freedom that somehow you found. So sometimes the way that I'll reframe it is just looking for pleasurable movement, not outcome oriented movement.
Yeah.
And pleasurable movement can really be anything.
Yes.
Again, it's like do what you do out of love, not out of hate. And sometimes the power walk is out of hate, you know? It's like, I hate myself, so I'm going to go for a power, right? Right. So it could be anything. But from the things that we've sort of put into the realm of exercise to even just the ergonomics of like doing what we're doing now. Like when I started, when COVID happened and all of a sudden I was teaching on the screen, I realized that I was hurting my neck because I was doing this to like look at people. And for your listeners who can't see what I just did, I just like hung my head forward and squinted at the screen, which I'm sure everybody's done. Yeah.
Oh my God. Turtle move.
Yeah, the turtle move. So I was like, I need to sit up straight and like really create some ergonomics for this new paradigm that don't hurt me, that don't hurt my body, you know? Mm-hmm. So there's the movement thing, and then there's the touch thing. And so touch is interesting because touch is like how you touch yourself, how you touch others, how you receive touch. So there's levels to it. But what I've learned from watching people in yoga is that they touch themselves unkindly, and they'll sometimes poke, or when they're describing their injuries, they'll be like, it hurts here, and they'll poke and be like, why are you poking yourself, right? And so people will poke, or they'll pinch, or they'll twist, or they'll hit, and so the beginning of this recalibration could be just touch yourself kindly, right, which you can do at any moment, and because you have self-consent, right, and then to use that as sort of the springboard for investigating how do you touch others, right? And you're communicating to them kindness and generosity to their bodies through touch. Mm-hmm. And then how is it that you give consent and receive touch from others, and how do they deliver touch? Mm-hmm. So there's all of these quadrants of touch that are very nuanced, but the place that we can begin all the time is how do we touch ourselves? And are we touching ourselves with kindness, with respect? Are we being gentle? Mm-hmm. Are we creating pleasure for our own bodies through the way that we touch ourselves? Like even like down to things like, how do you brush your hair? Or how do you brush your teeth? Are you aggressive with your gums? You know, how do you take care of your skin? You know, like when you apply the lotion, is it like slapdash and done? Or is it like something luxurious? Mm-hmm. And that can be a way that we recalibrate the relationship with our own body.
Right.
That then can recalibrate how we interact with other bodies as givers and receivers.
Mm-hmm. Right. Or I'm thinking specifically, I'm thinking, Erica, about the ways historically even, and I'm sure we can all relate to this, ways that we touch ourselves in places in our bodies that we are struggling to accept and be mm-hmm. okay with. And those specific parts of our bodies, and how do we touch those places?
Yeah, and that can be, I mean, like, I recalibrated my relationship with my ankles through a yoga practice that's called Abhyanga, which is basically self-massage, right? And my ankles have been a warehouse of a lot of trauma and injury for a long time. So this has been like a 5-7 year process of healing the ankles just by massaging them every day. Mm-hmm. Or it could be also masturbation, right? Because that is a way that you can start to recalibrate your own relationship with sexual trauma. Mm-hmm. So it can be like very intimate, or it can be very like
practical.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It can be practical. It'd be like, you know, like neck massage or scalp massage. It mm-hmm. can be all those things. Mm-hmm. And so that there, unless you have more reflections or questions, that concludes the 5 adoring core competencies, which is, again, like benchmarks that you can create a framework for assessing your relationship with your body in these areas. Mm-hmm. You're like, how's it going? Mm-hmm. Yeah. I would like to improve. I could improve in this area, you know? Mm-hmm. And of course, all of these are huge areas, but I think to kind of like categorize them and talk about some of the pitfalls and provide some tips, hopefully will bring the conversation into a realm that is manageable and like manifest instead of it being esoteric.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. That was lovely.
Thank you.
That was great. You know, one thing I so enjoy about these incredible interviews that we have with our guests is going back and listening. And I feel like I'm just like so excited. I'm like, oh, it's recording. I get to hear this all over again. I'm gonna take notes.
Yeah,
that's great. And this is so applicable, and it's so universal, and we're all in a body. Mm-hmm. We are all in a body. We all have this relationship. It doesn't matter how old you are, it doesn't matter what gender, doesn't matter the history that you hold within your body. This is here for all of us. And it's the work is never done.
Yeah. And Erica, I love when you point out about, you know, again, this can sound really obvious to a lot of people, but so many of us are disembodied, even if it sounds like, well, yeah, we're still disembodied in a lot of ways. And I love when you point out, like, you're so much more than your body. But you need to have this relationship with it that gets you to that ocean.
Yes.
That you are.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
Yeah. And I also, I hope we're not really giving people like, why do I need to read the book? We just touched on everything. But I do need to say, read the book. Go read the book. There's a lot more. But I also just want to say, I love your point about the, think of how much time there could be available to you if you put in a little bit of time, a little bit of thought to heal this part of us, how much could open up for other areas of our lives to do the things that we want to do and enjoy. And it's very liberating.
Yeah, and that's one of the key takeaways from the book. You know, you asked, like, what are key takeaways from the book on the whole?
Yeah.
And I think the project of the book has many layers, but the real motivator for me, and then I hope a takeaway, is that I believe that actually the future of our species hinges on this. Because when we are disembodied, we are not ourselves. And we are more likely to be tolerant of violence. And we're more likely to be tolerant of violence toward ourselves, towards others, towards our communities, towards the planet on the whole. And our society is inherently pretty violent from the ways that we work. I mean, maybe the big upshot of this will be that more people will be able to have better work conditions. I sort of don't think that's going to, I think the people who have jobs that are technological will have better work conditions. And I think everybody else will have worse work conditions. That's a big fear of mine, but at least it's brought up like how our work, does or doesn't work for us. Right. Mm-hmm. But then the Margaret, to what you were saying, like the key takeaway is if you quantify exactly how much time you spend actively disliking your body or the toll of simply not taking care of it, mm-hmm. and you prepared for the cost of not taking care of it now and freed up the time and the energy that you spend disliking your body, and you allocated all of that tremendous energy towards something you love and something mm-hmm. you care about, that our lives would be much better spent. Mm-hmm. And that this is like a human resource issue. Like if mm-hmm. we collectively freed up all of that energy and time and put it that we would be improved as a species tremendously. And that if we improved as a species, that would be tremendous mercy to the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. Because we're destroying the world.
Yeah. And there needs, from my opinion, that's, you know, evolving, is there needs to be a reckoning with that history point, you know? And for white folks, there needs to be a reckoning with being the oppressor. Historically, for people of color, it's a reckoning with being oppressed. It's very different states of being.
It is.
And I think for a lot of white folks, there's a lot of a big part of being disembodied is really not coming to not having that reckoning of the being part of the oppressive systems. Yeah. And, you know, it takes a lot of, it can feel.
Take some honest work.
Yeah.
Take some honest work.
But mm-hmm. that's why I love how you acknowledge walking through that pain is worth it. Mm-hmm. And, if I reflect now on how internally violent I've been towards myself, when I think of it that way now, it changes. It goes to another level for me now because I just won't accept that anymore.
Yeah. You're like, I got shit to do. This is enough. I got shit to do.
Right. Mm-hmm. So thank you. This truly is a gift. I feel like this is a very wise love letter. I'm going to be sending people this book. I like that I have the advanced copy tag on it, by the way.
Yes.
And now you're like, I got an advanced copy. Woohoo! Yeah, I'm so glad you got advanced copy. Yeah. I'm so happy.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure. And I hope that's such a nice way to put it. This is a love letter.
Erica, this has been such a great time to spend with you. Just delightful. Can we hold up that nice book for, do we have your permission to do a few IG clips with this? Your body friend, Erica Mather.
You want me to get my?
Oh yeah, you're all on the IG.
I have a book somewhere too. Let me see.
I love your posts.
Here it is. Oh yeah, you have permission to do whatever you want. Yeah, here we go.
Yep, your body, your best friend.
Ah,
the shore of your ocean. The shore of your ocean, everybody. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's your baby. It's what a journey that was to put that together. Woo-wee, humdinger.
Yeah.
Well, good job.
It's a much
congratulations.
9-month gestation, that's for sure. And I know that
that's okay.
The path of getting to the point of making a baby also involves a lot of pre-work, you know?
Yeah.
But what I've realized now is that now I have to help this baby grow up.
Yeah.
And you, my lovely ladies, are helping me do the work of helping my baby grow up.
This is really symbiotic. I mean, this is mutual, and you
very
are
mutual.
Also helping us.